or is it, are we still on that inevitable road? How do you see that?
I wish it could. It's something that's very, very close to my core interests, which is why I tossed off the line about the disappearance of humanity for better or worse, because I'm not sure it will be for the worse. But I think that the drivers are extremely powerful in society as it exists. Massive institutional structures, money and research and power. And the great paradox is right now is the U.S. with this bizarre religiosity of the ruling party. At the same time, it is the country with the most formidable research establishment that the world has ever seen. And it's steaming ahead. They have a little problem with a few stem cells is the only real problem they have. And, you know, they can go overseas if they want to go to England and see if they got to do this stuff. They can do it there. No big deal. And so, or they'll find a way around it. I have an example I'll show you tomorrow. British researchers have found a way around the stem cell problem. On Thursday,
I'll did you see the article about the stem cells not being viable because they're in, they've been contaminated? That was just came out.
No.
Like the last day or two.
This is in the States?
But the stem cells that Bush originally said, So it's kind of interesting where they're going to go.
They'll go to California. Right? Because California has approved $3 billion a year.
Yeah.
And so they'll do the work there. You see, the Bush prohibition is only for federally funded research.
Right, exactly.
So they'll easily get around it. So I think the institutional drivers are so powerful and so massive. And the time frame is so short. It's game over. Already, it's game over. We've got to start thinking about what the other side of this is going to be like. That's just my own view, that nothing can stop it. It's just game over. And that there will be a lot of people who will be interested, primarily the rich, and they will be, as suggested in the longer paper, they will be into creating restrictive genotypes that will breed with other people within 20 years. Yes?
If I can just ask a follow-up question on that. There seems to be sort of two kind of moments being tracked here. One is this kind of point of no return problem, which makes it sound as though we're reporting on the fact that, you know, there's rats all across Australia or something, and now we've got to clean them up. So it's a decision that, in a sense, wasn't taken. It's a kind of historical inertia problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you do keep speaking with a sort of language of agency, which means that there's a big moment of decision coming up, and it seems to happen in two theaters. One is when you say, in a kind of almost Bill Gates way, where would you like to go today? What else would you like?
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it's a kind of market sound, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, what else would you like? Fries with that kind of thing, right?
Yep.
So that makes it sound like the kind of sphere in which you're speaking. But then when you talk about the kind of decisions that are upcoming, that sounds more like a kind of Francis Fukuyama decision. We've got some big legal institutions that we need to be mobilizing and mobilizing quickly to get control. Now, when I think of Fukuyama, I think of Straussians and the police state. And I don't think that's the kind of thing that you're necessarily gesturing towards either. So when you're gesturing towards this moment of decision, what kind of sort of collective action or dialogue are you envisioning, or what is that? What are you?
Well, I just wanted to put that on the table, but you're right. I mean, one is, you could call it a top down, a bottom up. I certainly don't like the top down approach because those are the folks who are going to take it for themselves and deny it to others. Bottom up is so much more problematic because how are you going to work? You know, we have the beginnings of it. We have some debates about ethical and legal implications. There's a little bit of an attachment on the Genome Canada Project, OGELS, in which that kind of research is funded. There's some good people like Tim Caulfield in Alberta on the law and ethics side. Compare that to the engine of science that we're dealing with. And I just simply think, I think there will be such attempts. We'll stumble around as we did with the legislation on assisted human reproduction. It took 15 years. getting away without a date the moment it came into law. And I think we will try that, and that the engine will just go blast by. But which doesn't mean that we're not under the obligation to try. To try to rein it in. So I think we should. It's not a foregone conclusion, although the game is stacked.
I was just going to ask you, do you see sort of law and policy and regulation as the main tool?
Those are traditional tools, but yes, they're the tools we have. The problem is that we now almost have to up them to the international arena because, as I say, the ease of which you can move this stuff around, and that is so hard to do, even if you've got to sort it out in your own country to take it to the next step. But yes, law, policy, and regulation are the tools. They are there in principle. They could do it. Well, I've actually written about this. The mismatch between the pace of the scientific engine and the pace which goes faster and faster, and the other side, the law and policy, goes slower and slower because you have more stakeholders who have more rights involved, slows everything down. The best example is this Assisted Human Reproduction Act, which was finally passed in 2002. To which they had to add cloning at the last minute because cloning, when they first introduced the bill, cloning, mammalian cloning hadn't happened. Well, the problems, that would just deal with the problems of sperm banks, all the trivial stuff, right? They realized it in the late 80s, they put in a royal commission, and Patricia Baird of UBC reported in 93, says we have an urgent need for legislation. 10 years later, we got it, and it gets slower. So it's the relative mismatch of the two that I think one can demonstrate.
Just out of curiosity, because you mentioned it earlier, I mean, law, politics, and regulation. Thank you. Law, politics, and regulation would be one way of dealing with it, but you mentioned religion earlier. Do you think there's a religious aspect to
control? Well, we'll talk about this next time. I think no one who looks at the modern world can say that the religious framework is irrelevant. It's quite alive. And, you know, you walk around mumbling to yourself, same-sex marriage is what we're on about. But it is. It's a fact. And go look at the U.S. and so on, or elsewhere in the world. So yes, I think it will be, and I'd like to go into that in some depth in on Thursday, because I do think that, I mean, I tend to think in these kind of polarizations that come out of my Hegelian training, that it is genetics which will drive the wedge between the uneasy alliance of science and religion. You can't accept both stories of the divine creator and DNA. And you, as Laplace said, if you're a scientist, I don't need that hypothesis. It doesn't do anything for me. And that's why I find the U.S. so fascinating, because there you do have this, even the social movement to try to get creationism into the schools and to circumscribe the teaching of Darwinianism and so on. So I'd like to talk about that more, because I do think it seems to be building strength and not diminishing.
I guess my question for you would be, and I might have breezed over it and just missed it in your article, but it relates to the Terminator gene and the idea of this sterile seed. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you could comment on whether, when it comes to the Human Genome Project and related activities, whether that, I mean, $5 billion, I think, was the earmarked paycheck for that project. And obviously the profit coming back is expected. So when it comes to whatever you might want and being better than well, is there research into putting an expiry date on the fixes that you go in to get? The idea that you become much more an ongoing consumer, a lifelong member, I guess?
Well, it seems to be two different questions. I mean, the expiry date for most genetic interventions for a person would be, well, don't do it in the germline. It'll die with you. That's why there's much more controversy about germline gene therapy, for obvious reasons. You pass it on to your kids, and then it's into the gene pool, and although I do expect this to happen, there'll be all kinds of new alterations out there, and the interactions between them should be quite interesting. But we won't. It'll take a long time when you're talking about that type of diffusion. But still, the issues about germline engineering are very, very sensitive, and they're both ethical and political. And they have issues about intergenerational relations. But so that the easiest way to do the end date is to not do germline therapy. But on the other hand, I can foresee a place in which indeed you would keep going back as they discovered new things, new forms of gene therapy or gene enhancement, which can be done on the whole body, as I mentioned. They don't have to be done in the fetus or in the zygote. And we just go back regularly for a checkup and say, well, what's new? Give me some of that. Absolutely. No question.
I guess there's no addictive quality to it? And the idea that that would be the motivation is the addiction.
In a psychological sense, that you'll always want to be better and better. So, yeah. But I think it'll be, this will be highly socially stratified. There will be certain people who have access to this and others who won't. Yes?
I was thinking about how we had a situation with our antibiotics, and how we've now created diseases that are much more vicious.
Yeah.
If we go down this road with genetics, would we be setting ourselves up for something else that we do not even know that exists? Would we generate something from doing this?
That is a possibility. We should have a geneticist in the room look at that. I have cited certain things in my work. There's a notorious case in Australia with the mousepox virus. They were fooling around with the growth hormone. They actually wanted to create a mouse contraceptive for research mice. They thought they knew what they were doing. They got a completely and totally unexpected result. It freaked them out. In fact, they thought it was so serious in terms of its terrorism implications that they went to the Australian government, who kept it secret for 2 years, and told them not to publish it. Because the mousepox virus, what happened was they thought they were doing something with the reproductive system. As Conrad mentioned, they got another result. And what happened is that they produced a version of the mousepox virus, very common in mice, so virulent that it killed every animal, including those who have been inoculated against it. But the mousepox virus is very close genetically to the human smallpox virus. That's why they freaked out. And they sat on it for 2 years, and eventually they published it on the grounds that you've got to get it out there and get people looking at countermeasures for this type of thing, because sooner or later somebody else will discover it. But yes, they reported being completely and utterly baffled as to how this happened. So there will be lots of those kind of things along the way. And they may or may not be benign, or they may have consequences. Of course, it's the environmental release that one would worry about, where you can't get it back again. So that it's inevitable that will happen. The question is, do we have protocols in place that will control it from spreading or being applied to other uses? But it's absolutely inevitable. But I meant to say to Conrad, who had to leave to teach class, that with respect to these probabilities, what will be on offer, I think, in the when this is all completed, is that if you say, well, I can only give you an 80% chance, and then you're on one of the 20%, you either get no result or you get an unintended bad result, well, then they'll try to fix it. There will be repairs. At first some people may die and so on, as some have in some of these things, but they'll work it out and they'll work on repairing it. So, I do think that this project will be completed in a sense that we will be able to control these manipulations to a high degree of certainty. Not 100%, but a high degree. Now, the 5% or so could be catastrophic. I wouldn't deny that possibility. But it's mostly in the area of unintended manipulations, not the intended ones. It's people who are going to monkey around with pathogens, viruses, bacteria, because they're so easy. And I have referenced articles on bioweapons and that how easy it is, because they've sequenced all those genomes. it's a piece of cake. So nobody would fool around with the other stuff. It's too complicated. Just work on those single cell organisms and sky's the limit.
You seem to think that a lot of this genetic point, or you do think a lot of this genetic point with humans is inevitable. Mm. Do you think that...
Actually.
Yeah. But do you think that... I'll learn to look for this thing. But do you think that the development of an absolute bioweapon is inevitable as well? I mean, you talk about what happened with mice and stuff. Right? There's
not inevitable. And there are countermeasures to these things if we have the system in place. Even viruses and bacteria, they spread at certain rates. So if it happens and so on, if we have capacity to do rapid gene sequencing and can figure out an antidote quickly, then we can stop it. So there's no inevitability there in those catastrophe scenarios. It's more like there's a bunch of cute questions at the end of this article on cosmetic neurology. So you can all take this test because this is what the author designed it that way. I invite readers to consider their own views on the following questions. One, would you take a medication with minimal side effects half an hour before Italian lessons if it meant that you could learn the language more quickly? Two, would you give your child a medication with minimal side effects half an hour before piano lessons if it meant that they learned to play more expertly? Three, would you pay more for flights whose pilots were taking a medication that made them react better in emergencies? How much more? Four, would you want residents to take medications after nights on call, medical residents, that would make them less likely to make mistakes in caring for patients because of sleep deprivation? And five, would you take a medicine that selectively dampened memories that are deeply disturbing? So he's saying that, you know, people are going to be asking themselves those questions soon. So you can ask them too. I think I really want to learn Italian, so my answer to the first one is yes.
I'm really glad you brought that up about pregnancy, because I went through something similar when I was pregnant with my firstborn. I was 33 and I didn't want any kind of intervention at all, and I agreed to have an alpha fetal protein test, which...
What's that?
It's just a preliminary screening test that checks for certain substances in your blood. It's a blood test.
Okay, but not for the fetus.
Right. Now, statistically, when you're already over 30, the results that you're going to get back are that you're at a very high risk of carrying a Down syndrome baby.
High risk.
Well, at a high risk, elevated risk for sure. And at that point, you know, they want you to have an amniocentesis.
Right.
And I didn't want that. So I was in Boston at the time, and I had the entire HMO come down on me.
Can you tell me why?
I didn't want an amniocentesis? Well, I'll get to that in a moment. First of all, I was convinced that I didn't have a Down syndrome baby. That was my first point, right? So, like, what did I know? Mm-hmm. And I didn't, actually. But anyway, and secondly, I had an experience when I was about 10 years old. I grew up in a really authoritarian family that basically said, you know, it's better to get rid of these defective people and so on and so forth. And when I was about 10, I had these 12-year-old friends, and they knew that there was an institution somewhere outside of Winnipeg where children were kept, like nuns took care of very, very handicapped kids. And these friends of mine said, let's take the bus out there and ask if we can, you know, get into the institution and see the waterhead babies. No, really, I mean, you know, we were punks. So
I'm not laughing, I'm thinking just a lot like my childhood.
Yeah, so we took the bus out there, and the nuns let us in. I guess we gave them some line about can we volunteer and help around. And they let us in, but they didn't show us the worst cases. And instead, they had us push kids in wheelchairs around, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, everything. And the next week, you know, they expected us to come back. And my friends, they said, we're not going back there. So I went back. I don't know why. I went back, and I went back a few more times and, you know, took care of these kids for, I don't know, 40 minutes or an hour or something like this, just helped the nuns out.
Mm.
And it was really a life-changing experience to see these handicapped children, first of all, as a group, and to see these nuns taking care of these kids, and to see that there was this valuable interaction going on, that these quote-unquote weaker elements were actually giving something to the caretakers, that the caretakers were getting something out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, after that, I could only sort of snarl every time my authoritarian parents, you know, made another comment about, let's get rid of, you know, retards.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was pregnant, well, I was a graduate student, so I was mouthy, and I thought I knew everything anyway, and I said, I'm not having this test, because only Nazis do that. They selectively get rid of, you know, unwanted genetic material. And that whole HMO came down on me. I mean, the nurse practitioner was nearly hysterical, and the final upshot was, if you don't have this test, we might get sued. Okay, mm-hmm. so the long and the short of it is that I left the HMO and went to a birth center and just worked with midwives, and that was that. And my kid is healthy, and when I had this, I had a second one, and luckily she was healthy as well. And I would not be so blithe anymore about not having any tests, because now I know how much work kids are.
Yeah.
You know, they call it labor, but the work really starts after they're born.
Yeah.
So so I understand when parents are nervous and they want to have these tests and they want to have these assurances, but it really starts at that individual level. And when you're offered those tests, and you've got everybody, you know, in the room saying to you, but you have to have that test, you have an elevated risk, you may have Tay-Sachs, you may have this, you may have that, you know, they throw out everything that they can think of.
Yeah.
And besides, if you don't do it, then we haven't taken care of you properly, and you can sue us, because
That's the U.S.
Because in this system, we are practically obliged to guarantee you a successful outcome. Who's going to say no? You know, you have to have almost, I don't know, some sort of weird experience as a youngster to stand up and say, no, I don't want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you will say yes, I will have these tests, and I will make sure that it's like that little quiz at the end of the article, you know, you will. And what I think what we're missing as a society, as a kind of a discourse, is we have no way to talk about the value of the weak in society. We just don't seem to have those tools. You know, we focus on the bigger, the better, the stronger, the brighter, the smarter.
Yes.
But we don't have any way to talk about what the value is of the weaker elements in our society. The detritus, the cast-off, or whatever.
Almost. That is precisely, I know the billboard to which Andrea was referring, and that is precisely, I think, thank you, that is precisely the intended message, as I see it, of the billboard to which Andrea is referring.
And then on the other hand, you're saying that we don't have enough of that kind of as a discussion within the society, right? It's just sort of, no, let's all focus on the bigger, the better, the stronger, but let's not talk about...
Well, I guess my point was that I'm not being in the field per se. All the examples I hear are of, you know, the kind of the elite athletes, the super brains, the chess stars, and everything like that. And when I think about it, and after having actually been a part of an elite athletic group, how dysfunctional that really was in the first place. But when we left sport, we realized nobody really cared about that. Like after the 92 Olympics, people were like, oh, is that this year? You know, like, and then I started to think, you know, that's where I hear all this, the examples of this type of genetic research kind of, that's the discourse.
Yeah.
But really, after becoming pregnant, I see it's much more hitting the ground in an everyday population in kind of an insidious type way. But I was going to say that my experience in BC with doing a midwifery kind of route was to experience this discourse, this kind of counter discourse around that type of research that was about empowerment and not necessarily about me being like against the man or against the system, but informing me of what that test actually involved and the kind of thinking, okay, here are both roads. And I felt that that was kind of an interesting place to be, and I really did feel like I was at
the
crossroads, and it was up to me. And so it was a really kind of consent-driven, information-driven decision that I made.
I would just add, though, I think that that fact that it was up to you is one of the reasons that it becomes so difficult for those who are most at risk of being silenced through genetic enhancement, genetic technology, and these sorts of things that you've been talking about. the fact that they don't get a voice, because we conceptualize of genes in connection to reproduction, which we see has been very much a matter for, at the most, a couple or the individual. Mm-hmm. And when I look at these drawings, I don't see social responsibility attached or visualized or given a kind of voice. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, nor did I hear that very strongly in your introduction. You started with the biology. Mm-hmm. And as if that was the starting ground, the kind of the truth or the fact part that we needed to begin with. And I have something of a problem with that, I guess, because then you run the risk then of saying, well, everything else becomes something that we need to talk about later, or everything else is something that becomes too complex that we really can't talk about it, or it is just up to the individual. And so it then becomes very hard to get any kind of collective voice and some sort of agency building among groups of people to talk about what are the social responsibilities of the scientists. What are our social responsibilities now that we've listened to you talking to go out and talk about this? What are our responsibilities in the classroom and so on? So I didn't have a question, just a comment.
I'm wondering where are the lines of who's deciding what is a genetic anomaly that should be corrected? And what is a genetic anomaly that doesn't need to be corrected? Where is that?
That I think it may or may not be hard and fast. I mean, I think in some cases, for most people, it would be pretty clear. And that's what I think they mean when they say these are disease genes. They incapacitate or they induce pathologies, some of them very severe pathologies like Huntington's. I suspect that there are shadings. That's why I was trying to get into that with the mental function thing, because I think it's maybe more of an issue there than with the bodily function. But I think that will be an issue. I don't have a complete list. We don't have a complete list from the biologists of what they think the whole set of inherited disease genes are, or the inherited capacities or inherited pathologies. So I think that will be an issue.
Well, I'm thinking of something like learning disabilities.
Yes.
You go to the extreme and then slight. And
yes.
I think of some people who have had them, and a lot of our authors or artists, great thinkers, have been subject to such a thing. And if we go towards a world where we have none of these, mm-hmm. what do we end up with?
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of perfection theme. And where perfection is designed as you don't have anything which is designated as something that's incapacitating. And actually, Asperger's would be a really good example, because which is called high functioning autism, because there are deficits without a doubt. There are socialization deficits that can be quite severe, although not as severe as regular autism. But there are some extraordinary flowerings of the human mind in such people. It doesn't mean to say that only such people have those, but, and you've probably read about them. They include both mathematical memory, actually visualization. The famous architect for that. And also, you can think of this as, well, this is part of the human thing. There's a wonderful novel, if you're interested in this, go get the book, Mark Haddon, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's about a high-functioning autistic child. It's beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And it does give you some sense of, well, this is an interesting kid. So, absolutely right, there will be a shading. Is this a dysfunction that we ought to eliminate? That'll be on the table, for sure. One of the things that you said, I think, is very relevant to discussions, and we can carry that on Thursday. I do get the impression that most people think that decisions about reproduction are private and personal, family decisions, and not social decisions. And I think this will be a powerful driver for people to say, I'm going to decide whether I want some of this or not. And there will be, there will clearly be a point at which society, if it's still functioning at all, will have to step in and say, well, wait a minute. There are collective interests here. But I think it's going to be very difficult to assert them. Oh, maybe Thursday we can pick it up again.
Then maybe Thursday we can pick up on that. You did offer a book.